I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Welcome to Minute 66 of Season 6 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is John Parker of the Bat Minute. Welcome to the show.
I felt like I had to say that. Hello.
Okay, that's a good way to do it. Hee-haw, hello. Is your name Sam Wainwright? Or
that is my real name. My podcasting name is John Parker. It's a forgery. It's a fake. I'm a liar.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, it's no skin off my nose, so. Yeah. All right.
Thank you for inviting me. This is it's my first time on the show.
Yes, it is.
I have, despite we said off mic that I've only had time to listen to one episode of this season, but I've heard other episodes from previous seasons, so it's exciting to be on.
Well, I'm glad that you were able to find the time to, and that we were both able to find the time for us to record this. I'm very glad. I've had your partner in crime on twice already for you know, last season and this season, so you know it's good to get the other half on also.
Just don't get us together; it's a nightmare.
No, I won't. I do my best. I do my best to try to have one guest, not multiple guests at the same time. I mean, anyone who listened to the episodes last week will hear that I had two, and it made things a little bit more complicated. But, you know, I'm sure everyone already knows about that. So I don't need to go back.
Once we had me, Niall, and three guests.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if I can handle that.
That was it was tough. But at the same time, I learned halfway through recording, I can just sit here like drinking coffee and let them talk. It's fine.
Yeah, but don't you want to be a part of the conversation?
Yeah, but it's also, it's like a private podcast sometimes just for you, and you can enjoy it that way. Like,
Okay. Hey, if that works. You mean you get to listen in on the unedited version?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that makes sense. I didn't think about it from that perspective. I don't know. I like to be an active participant. Let's put it that way. I mean, I was on a lot of episodes of The Lamb where sometimes we had six or seven people. We even had one where we had like 100 people on and off throughout the course of 3 hours.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was very interesting. It was, I think it was the 500th episode of The Lamb where Jay did that. Maybe it was the 400th episode. I don't remember. It was a few years ago. It was very interesting and it was great. And then when we did the farewell thing to Jay, we also had like 100 people on. Everyone had like their own segments.
Hey.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. But
that's
awesome
idea. I'm into that as like a special. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I think the most I've been on is like six people in a conversation. You know, that type of thing. Which can be fun. I mean, you have to be the right person to be wrangling everything, you know, being the host. You know, you don't want to be one of those people where you feel as if you're not contributing and you're just sitting in the corner like John likes to do, drinking his coffee.
Yeah, it's not like when you are forced to do like a Microsoft Teams meeting with your work and you don't want to contribute. And at the very end, at the very end, you say, thanks, everybody. And then think in their mind, oh, you contributed.
That's right. You start off by at the beginning by saying hi everyone, and then at the end, thank you everybody. And there you go. You've been a part of it. Meanwhile, you know, you're playing some video game on the other screen at the same time throughout the entire.
Have you been watching me?
Yes, I have.
That's almost exactly what I do. Because to be fair, I'm not going to say who I work for here because I don't get in trouble. But my boss says that to me. He's like, look, there's this meeting we all have to be on, but it's pointless. Just like watch Netflix or something. It's like, okay.
Hey, if he's willing to let you do that, then that's good.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, I what I try to do when I'm in those type meetings is, you know, I'm actively looking at another screen. You know, sometimes my boss will write me a message by WhatsApp in the middle and say, why don't you pay a little more attention? People see what you're doing, you know, or people see that you're doing something else. Let's put it that way. And I'm like, well, I don't have anything to contribute anyway. You know, I might as well get
they want
I might
to
get
pretend,
work done.
Though, you know.
Yeah, but I'm trying to actually get work done at the same time. That's where, you know, these meetings interfere with work.
That's the thing. The people who do these meetings, they're not actually interested in work. That's not what it's about. It's about appearances.
That's right. I completely agree with you on that. And that's part of the problem for us. You know, when we want to have these type of conversations, these are ones we want to have.
Exactly.
Yeah. So why don't you first tell people what's your background with the movie It's a Wonderful Life, if you have
one? Well, I do indeed. I do. I'm going to keep it sort of short because I'm going to revisit some of this stuff later in the week, which will make sense. But basically, my ex-partner, we were together for like 15 years. And every Christmas, her family would take us to watch It's a Wonderful Life. I didn't grow up watching this movie. So I think I first watched it, I would have been with them, I think I was about 22 or so. But it's on every Christmas here in Liverpool. And they would take me every year. And at first, because I was being a bit of a young snob, let's say, I was like, oh, I don't want to go see some old Christmas movie. Oh, that's gonna suck. That's going to be so boring.
And there's no Batman in it.
And there's no Batman in it, right? It's not going to be exciting. Instantly thought, oh, that was great. And so then every year I looked forward to it more and more and more. So the last couple of years since we've separated, it's been a bit weird. It's been like, oh, I felt odd watching it. So it was very good to be asked to do this because it was a great excuse to make myself watch it again and enjoy it again in a new way.
Do you feel you were cheating by watching
my connection to the film, you know?
Did you feel like you were cheating by watching it?
A little bit. Yeah, I felt a little naughty.
Okay.
No, it was great because now I've done it for this. I'm like, oh, I can go back to watching this yearly again now. You know, it's sort of broken that that strange feeling. And instantly, as soon as I watched this, I sort of regretted not seeing it as a kid. But then again, as a kid, I probably wouldn't have been into it. You know, I wouldn't have really understood the themes and things like that.
Well, that's one of the things I love about when you see a movie as a kid, you see things from a certain perspective. And then as you get older, when you rewatch it, you see it in other, you know, in newer eyes, in different eyes.
Yeah.
That type of thing. Which is why, like on my website, when I review movies, I will review movies more, you know, numerous times because I don't care because I know that every time I watch the movie, I'm going to notice something different. You know, like I've seen Return of the Jedi 70 something times. And I think on my website, I've reviewed it maybe 15 times or 16 times, something like that, over the last 10 years. You know, and each time
I support
it's different.
That. See, that's my favorite movie of all time.
Is it really?
People always think that's a weird one. Everyone likes Empire. It's like, well, I think Jedi's got the highest highs. It's got the some lows as well. Don't get me wrong. It's not, you know. There's stuff to criticize. It's also got one of the worst acted scenes of all time, I think. But it's my favorite movie. It's got the darkest bits of Star Wars. It's got the lightest bits of Star Wars. It's got everything.
Yeah. Wait, how old were you when you saw it?
I was like 3.
You saw it in the theater?
No.
Okay. See, I was 9 when it came out, and I saw it 17 times in the theater.
I mean, yeah. I am 37, so I don't even think, was I alive when it came? I wouldn't have been alive.
No, you weren't. No.
So no, but my parents bought me the VHS of like all of them when I was like 3 years old. I'm just like, put this on. This will keep them quiet.
And then you say, look at those cuddly little Ewoks.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, you've got the Ewoks, which I love. I have no problem with them. But then you've got the Emperor. And it's like, oh, that! What a shift in tone. Holy crap.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's similar here. Like, if I saw this as a kid, I don't know what I would think of this. Because to me, seeing this as an adult, it's quite explicitly, it's like a working class movie with working class themes. It's like sort of anti-capitalist. And I don't think kids really connect with that.
Well, of course not. You know.
Yeah.
The question is, I'm curious what kids think of this movie. Now that I think about it, you know, it's like, because I saw this the first time when I was a teenager. I must have been probably around 15 or 16 when it was the first time I saw this movie. And I've always loved it. But I'm wondering if kids will understand the whole aspect of, you know, the frustration of the character and the attempted suicide and, you know, the idea of an angel, like all these different things. Interesting.
And not like a normal idea of an angel. It's a very different, I don't want to say the word realistic because that sounds a bit strange. We're talking about a supernatural entity. But if
it's a down-to-earth, perspective of an angel.
Yeah, yeah. Not what I was expecting. The first time I was dreading that character when he first popped up because I was thinking, oh, God, all of these old movies always have one character that angers me that's just silly and it's not funny anymore. Like, the humor doesn't work. But he still holds up, I think.
Okay, that's Clarence for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I think it's like Bride of Frankenstein, is it? Where there's that one character, it's a woman who's like the comedy relief, and that movie's near perfect. But oh god damn it, she angers me. She's not funny. It doesn't work.
Okay, makes sense. All right. So episode 66 begins with Sam Wainwright showing up and ends with the rent collector explaining the situation. So we basically ended things on Friday with the martinis about to go. They're moving towards their new home.
Yeah.
And this minute begins with them actually arriving at their home. And then we see George and Mary standing outside of this brand new home that the martinis have built. And then we get a shot. And we ended things on Friday with them saying, Mr. and Mrs. Martini, welcome home.
Oh, what a nice way to end the minute.
Yes, it was. We did a nice job ending that on Friday. And so when you look at the way things continue today, so the scene basically opens up, the minute opens up with Sam Wainwright standing by his car. And he turns to the woman next to him and goes, good old George, he's always making a speech. Now,
does he really make that? I'm trying to think throughout the movie. He does a couple of speeches, I suppose. But, no, but he knows him better than us, the viewer. He's his friend, you know.
Correct. No, but I guess the question is, you know, is George the guy on the soapbox? You know, is he the one always talking about other people? He's not, because he's the guy who wants to travel the world. Those are the speeches he makes. He doesn't make speeches saying, I want to help out the little fella. I mean, that's what he does in reality, but he doesn't make speeches about it. His speeches are all about wanting to get out of here. You know,
it's
I don't want to stay.
An interesting character in that sense, because he wants to live for himself and be a little bit, I don't mean this in a negative way, a little bit selfish. He wants to do something for him, but he can't. He feels drawn to helping others. So it's quite that's quite fascinating. It's like, but you need to do something for yourself for once, man. Come on.
That's true. But part of the thing also is it's very funny. You say he wants to do something selfish for himself, but it's not really for himself, because his ideas are to help out the world.
That's true. Yeah.
You know, he does want to become an engineer. He wants to build skyscrapers and bridges and, you know, all these other things that he talks about that he wants to build. But he's not building them for George Bailey. He's building for the little people. His problem, George's problem throughout the entire movie, is not the fact that he doesn't want to help others. It's that he feels that working in the building and loan is belittling to him, because, you know, he feels that he can help more.
Yeah, he's got grander ambitions, not for him. As you say, maybe for the wider world. Like,
that's right.
Mike and Collins could help be helping many more people.
Correct. And I mean, that's part of the whole point of this movie, to show that you know, that he thinks that he's not helping with what he's doing, but he's actually helping. In some ways, he's perhaps helping more than if he were to be in the big world, you know, doing everything.
Well, yeah, because what would become of these people? Really?
That's right.
Well, we see what becomes of them if he's not
there. Yes, yes. That we find out in the the Biff Tannen future that we get later on.
I think that was the first time I watched this. That was the first thought I had. I was like, hang on, this is like Back to the Future, or more correctly, Back to the Future's like this.
Yeah, exactly. But again, if you saw Back to the Future Part 2 first, which I did also, you know, so that's what you think. You look at this movie and you're like, hey, Pottersville is I'm trying to remember what the name.
Yeah.
Did they change the name of the town?
You would think I would know. I've seen that movie 8,000 times.
So have I. I'm trying to think of what the name of it is.
Let's just call it Tannenville. It's probably not.
Yeah. That's really weird. I can't believe I can't remember that either.
No, same. But it's the,
you know, you have it's I okay. It's called Hill Valley. Okay, it is Hill Valley.
Just Hill Valley.
But the question is in Back to the Future, does it change? Did they change the name to something?
Let's call it Biff Valley then.
Nah, that doesn't sound right.
No, I do get the impression though that maybe making that film, they did watch this, and were like, okay, let's make a kind of a funny and super dark version. Let's take it to another level.
Correct.
Because it feels very inspired by it. It's not just like a little bit like this, the same concept. It's like, no, it's basically the exact same, just even more depressing.
Which is more depressing, here or there?
I think Back to the Future, because it's ruled by a full-on... He's not just evil. He's like a fascist, basically. He gets away with, like, killing people and things. It's like really, like, oh.
Wait a second, you don't think Potter would do that?
I think he might. He might, but we don't see that fully realized, do we? It doesn't go to that level. It might hint at it.
Correct, but we do see the way that the... I mean, we're jumping way ahead, but we do see... The difference in the way that Bedford Falls looks, you know, there's you know, even Bert the Cop, starts, he's just shooting for no reason. You know, he's got instructions to shoot anyone who, That's causes true. Problems, like touching the librarian.
Well,
that's a big no-no.
You deserve punishment for that.
Apparently. Yeah. So basically, Sam and his wife, who we will find out later, her name is Jane, are sitting there, or she's sitting in the car and he's sitting outside of the car, and they're looking over at the spectacle that's going on in Bailey Park. And, you know, I never thought about this before, but Sam Wainwright has a chauffeur.
Yeah. I found that really strange because it does imply this is his car, right? It's not like a taxi.
That's correct. And not just that, it implies that Sam has really, really struck it big. And we're just talking a few months after he had his conversation with George and Mary, you know, telling them to you know, that he's going to let him in on the ground floor.
Yeah.
So it's very strange, you know, because we don't know the exact timeline of this whole thing. We know that you know, Harry came home and it was 1932. All right. And that was the night where he went to go see Mary. So that was still 1932. Then we saw their wedding. And then now, so I'm assuming that this is already 1933, maybe the beginning of 1934. You know, not much later than that. So we're still talking maybe within a year and a half that all this is happening.
Well, I've got more to say on that tomorrow, actually, but it is interesting to see. It doesn't go overboard with making a point of it. Like, it doesn't go, there isn't two characters having a conversation saying, oh, how amazing, he struck it rich, you know, and all. It's like, no, you've got to pay attention.
That's
like,
right.
You can see he's doing well. You can hear he's doing well without it being shoved in your face. That's much more interesting to me.
That's right. Well, I mean, I talked about this at in the first weeks. I listened to the commentary of this movie from there's a professor named Janine Bassinger. Mm-hmm. And one of the things she talks about there is the fact that Capra is a very visual director, meaning that there are things that go on in the story that he shows us and doesn't tell us. And if you're not watching and paying attention, you're not going to notice them. You know, for instance, the whole idea of Mr. Gower's son. You know, he shows us the telegram that we have to read ourselves. You know, he shows us that Mr. Gower is sitting there looking at a picture. So therefore, we know, we now know to infer that this is his son who's mentioned in the telegram. You know, and throughout the movie, there are a whole bunch of little subtle hints. And this is another one, you know, where you have to pay attention to what's going on. You know, Sam tells them, I have this great idea. And then, as you said, the next thing you see him, you know, in a nice suit, and we'll see, you know, how his wife is dressed. That already says something also. And the fact that he has this brand new car and he has, you know, a chauffeur and all that stuff. So
that's the craziest thing to me, because like, even back then, that must have been like very expensive. He's got a driver.
That's right.
That's crazy. What?
Correct. So do you where do you think the term chauffeur comes from?
That's an excellent question. I obviously it's a French word, but I don't know where it originates. I can't think of the I don't know.
Okay, so it is a French word, but in the French word means stoker.
Oh.
Okay. Because the early cars were steam powered.
Oh, so like stoking a fire.
That's right. Yeah. So the driver needed to stoke the engine, you know, by I guess turning the propeller type of thing. You know, they used to have those cars where you had to crank them to start it.
I love seeing people in movies like use that weird little crank.
Yes,
it looks hilarious.
Yes. So
cars,
I mean, basically,
had much more style back then. They were much classier.
That's right. And the chauffeur, his job was to deal with maintenance and cleaning, which is, I guess, why we always see in movies the chauffeur, you know, waxing the car. And, you know, they need to be able to fix any mechanical issues, including, you know, changing tires that get punctured along the way and things like that. Because apparently
it comes to these old-fashioned tires, I just think of The Simpsons, though, because Mr. Burns has a very ancient looking car that's a bit like, well, it's not even one of these, it's older than one of these. It's more like the one with the crank.
And that's right.
He pulls up to the gas station and he's like, what's his exact words? He's like, you there, fill her up with petroleum distillate and re-vulcanize my tires post haste.
Exactly. I mean, I found that there was an article in 1906 in the New York Times about chauffeurs. You know, and they were talking there about the problems that people were having with, you know, with having to find someone to become their chauffeur. And, it, you know, it happens to do with, you know, most of these people didn't want to drive themselves. So
was that seen as like lower class to do that?
That's correct. That's right. And basically, you know, the prices of what they would pay chauffeurs in 1906 was just crazy. You know, I can't believe that the amounts. They said that the chauffeur problem today is one of the most serious that the automobilist has to deal with, and complained that young men of no particular ability who had been earning from $10 to $12 a week. Okay, so let's first say how much $10 was in 1906.
That's got to be quite a good wage, I would think.
You know what? I looked in the inflation calculator, and it doesn't even go back that far.
Oh.
So I'm going to have a little bit of trouble getting the information about that one. I wonder what year it starts in.
But thinking about it, that's got to be quite good. Because I know people, you know, in England in like the 60s, if you got that kind of money, that was good. You know,
yeah, but wait a second. That's even before. That's the price before these people got these jobs. And then it says, so these people who are earning $10 to $12 a week are suddenly elevated to salaried positions, paying between $25 and $50 a week.
Oh, whoa. No, that they must have been rich, rolling in it.
Like, why would they want to work why would they want to work at a chauffeur when they're making that kind of money? I mean, the farthest I can go back is 1915. So $10 in 1915 is worth $304 today. Okay, so that was the standard thing. And again, this is 10 years after what we're talking about here. Now, if we're talking about $50, they were making, that means it's on today's exchange rate, it's $1,500 that they were making a week.
That what?
Why are there not more people who were chauffeurs?
This is insane. Isn't it amazing that people used to be able to, you know, support themselves with a job?
That's right.
It's not so easy these days, you know?
Yeah, that's just crazy.
Oh, that's wild. I wish I used to work for I work now for the government, and they don't give me that.
Yeah, no, I don't think very few people make that type of money. But that's just crazy. I mean, it's crazy the inflation calculator doesn't go back that far. But still, you know, you know, if we're talking 10 years later, it was $1,500. That's just crazy.
That is whoa. So again, it shows, you know, the wealth here. What's happening? He's on an upward swing.
That's right. Wow. Yeah, these are crazy. So yeah, basically, you know, Sam Wainwright is quite wealthy, and you know we'll find out what George thinks about that as the week goes on.
Oh,
you know, and then after he screams out and starts telling him hee-haw, so George looks over and goes, "Oh, Sam Wainwright," and you're not really sure about his tone here as to whether he's happy that Sam is there or not.
You know. I think he is happy in a way, but it's also a reminder that he could have gone and, you know, made money. And even though he's having this happy moment, you know, he's handing this home over.
That's right.
It's also a bit of a, you know, rubbing salt in the wound kind of thing.
That's right. Pun intended.
And, I was very taken by the sight of that salt, because Irish table salt. Like, oh,
there you go.
Okay. I assume it's from the Irish Sea.
Probably.
I've not heard of Irish tables though.
I haven't either. And I mean, I love how Mary just turns to him and goes, "Oh, who cares?" Yeah.
She is a voice of reason. She's just like, "What are you complaining about? Come on."
That's right. And she, you know, at this point decides that she's going to be giving over some housewarming gifts. So she turns to the martinis and goes, "Bread. That this house may never know hunger. Salt. That life may always have flavor." I guess Irish salt flavor. You should have Irish flavor here, I guess. You know, actually, isn't Irish flavor like booze?
You know, it's a stereotype, but also it is kind of true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And wine. That joy and prosperity may reign forever. What Enter the martini set castle. Gifts.
Imagine buying a place these days and getting anything off anyone.
That's right.
Yeah, nothing. I bought this house I'm in now, and I there was a washing machine still here, and the landlord, because it used to be rented out, the landlord I was buying it off said, "Oh, you can have all the stuff that's there if you want. It'll be £200." I was like, "Can't you just leave it? You're not going to take it."
That's right.
Now get a bottle of wine.
That's right. They got a bottle of wine. Did you notice though that as Mary is talking, you see George's eyes darting back and forth between the martinis and presumably Sam?
Yeah. I think he's a little perturbed. It's thrown him off his game a little bit.
Yeah.
He was feeling good. And now seeing his friend, he's not feeling good.
Right. And then, I think that's the reason why he actually then takes the bottle of wine and gives them the wine and says, "And wine, the joy and prosperity may reign forever."
Yeah.
Enter the martini castle. I think he wants to feel more important.
Yeah, like this is my moment. He wants his friend to see him like presiding over these festivities, doesn't he? Like, "No, look, I am gifting people things because I'm doing well."
That's right. And
also, is the bread thing, because I love that she gives them these, but is that like an American tradition, or are they just
okay? You jumped ahead on me on that one just slightly. No, that's okay, it's fine, it's perfectly okay, John. So I was gonna ask you if you know where the idea of bread and salt comes from.
Right, no, I mean, maybe that used to be a thing in England, I don't know, but it's certainly not now.
Okay, so the exchange of bread and salt as a sign of hospitality is common in many cultures. And many places that give bread and salt as a housewarming gift, in Russia, they used to do this, and in Germany.
Okay.
And it's actually a feature of Jewish housewarming traditions. Because, I mean, as a Jew, I can say that you know, every Friday night when we, you know, have our festive meal, so you always have bread and salt for some of these same reasons.
Okay.
You know, and you know, we also have wine. So
well,
there you go.
I mean, that's the Trinity. That's all you need, really. If it's good bread.
I don't know if Trinity is the right term to be using when talking about Jews, but yeah, okay.
Yeah, that was an accidental. I can use all the words as someone with no religion. I can co-opt it all.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I just thought it was very funny. I'm not offended by it.
To me, that's all you need, right? Good bread. I mean, maybe some butter or something. You don't. I can just sit and eat that.
Well, I think that's part of the idea.
Yeah.
You know these are staples that one needs in order to survive. And to be prosperous, I guess.
I love the symbolism. I think it's great. Like, yeah. I'm going to find out if England used to do this. And if we did, I'm bringing it back. I think it needs to come back. This is awesome.
Right. I mean, I saw that there were homogeneous cultures. They have different types of housewarming and stuff like that. It doesn't mention here anything about England. Sorry. You know, just the colonies.
we tend to be miserable people. So we don't like to give anyone anything. So you don't want to see your neighbors. Your task most days is to try and avoid them.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. So in Greece, people give pomegranates as a housewarming gift.
Nice.
Because it was considered the fruit of the dead.
It
had strong connections to marriage and wealth and featured in the myth of Persephone.
Okay. See, I love pomegranates. I used to live in Cyprus, so I could get them there quite easily.
Yeah. Well, we have them here in Israel. We have them a lot also.
Lovely, but aren't they really like complicated? They're fiddly.
No,
you know, you've got to do stuff. It's like, oh, I just want to bite it like an apple.
okay. No, but the whole idea is you need to know how to open it and get on all the seats. You know, that's what it comes down to. It's messy. That's what it comes down to.
But when you're like a six-year-old kid stealing them off trees and things, you know, you don't want to be doing that.
That's true. There were places in Europe and America where they would give pineapples as a housewarming gift.
Was that because it was expensive and hard to get?
Yes, it was.
Aha, there you go.
That's right.
Because isn't that kind of strange to us to think about these days, where it's quite easy to just sort of get whatever you want whenever you want, but obtaining a pineapple, that was like a challenge.
And yes.
That was like a really like exotic fan. It was probably very expensive.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's true.
I think we're ruined these days. Like, I could just go down to the shop right now and get a pineapple. It's like,
That's right. And most fruits and vegetables you can get all around the year. You know, you just have to pay a little more to get them. You know, it's not as if things are completely seasonal.
No. And I actually think there's a beauty to the seasonal thing. It makes you try more. It makes you sample new things because, that's what you get now. So that's what I'm going to give. You know, I'm going to try and make a nice dish out of this.
Right. Okay, that's fair. That's fair. Did you notice that the martinis cross themselves as they get each of these gifts?
Yes. That's very sweet of them. They're like, oh, it's like, oh, bless you kind of a thing.
Is it bless you, or is it basically thanking someone up above?
Oh, that's good. Well, I suppose it could be both, really. It could be like they're thanking God for sending George with these gifts, if you know what I mean. Like,
right.
They're all connected, these concepts, aren't they?
Right, exactly. And as this happens, you know, the we get a screen wipe, and we're thrown into a potter's office.
Oh.
And we have we have someone speaking to Potter, and I could not find out this actor's name. Because even in on IMDb under the uncredited, there are so many people that don't have real explanations as to who they are. We don't have someone that's like the rent collector or something like that. So if anyone out there is able to figure out who this actor is, feel free to let me know, because there are so many uncredited actors here. You know, there are a few that just have a first name. I don't really know which one that could be. and stuff like that.
Yeah. Back in this era, they didn't have the sort of established system for these kind of things, did they? They were just like, just put your friends in it. Who cares? They didn't keep a log.
That's right. That's right. And people, I guess the guy said, okay, I got my, $50 for the day, and that was it. You know, like, they didn't really care.
Yeah.
Afterwards,
about cash in hand, you know, it wasn't done there.
They never thought that there was going to be an IMDb where, you know, you can go and see everything where these people are. You know, how many? There, maybe it's a nervous banker. I don't know. That's the closest
That's why I like doing minute by minute as well, because there was never, ever, ever a time where anyone would have thought with movies, people are going to analyze it this deeply. So you random things that you. I imagine the filmmakers will just like, just leave that in. It's fine. No one will notice.
That's right. Oh, I mean, I found so many fun things over the last six seasons that are things that, you know, we found in The Great Escape, we found that somebody was carrying a guitar. And someone else, there's another musical instrument that we found that they later used when they were creating the booze. I'm trying to remember what it was. Yeah, it was like, oh, wait a second, that's the tuba or whatever. I don't remember what it was. And it was just like, it was amazing.
That's the funniest thing to me, though, is people say to me like, oh, you must remember everything about Batman, right? Because you've analyzed it so much. And I'm like, no, because I'm analyzing them all so much, I forget it all.
That's right, because there's so much more to know.
Yeah. I forget everything I've spoken about on the show.
Okay, so here we are back in Potter's office. And, you know, there's a man standing next to him. Across the desk from him, and he goes, look, Mr. Potter, it's no skin off my nose. I'm just your little rent collector, but you can't laugh off this Bailey Park anymore. Look at it. And then, he has a big map in front of him showing different things and stuff like that. You know, it's a very it's interesting to see someone else in this movie sort of stand up to Potter.
I really like this character. I actually wish he was in it a bit more, because he's fascinating in that. He is obviously, he's a rent collector, as you say. So he's part of this landlord system. So he's not a truly like great man of the people, but even he is like, you know, this isn't working. Like,
right.
You're going to have a problem here. You know, what are you going to do about this? Otherwise we're screwed. And in fact, might be jumping ahead a little bit. He threatens to walk.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and basically, you know, as they're talking, we hear a buzz. They're interrupted by the intercom, and we hear a woman on the intercom say, Congressman Blatz is here to see you, sir. And then Potter goes, oh, tell the congressman to wait. And then he turns to him and says, go on. So this establishes, once again, you know, something we were talking about earlier, but the way that they subtly tell us things in this movie, you know, he's basically showing how powerful a man he is. That even a congressman has to sit and wait.
Yeah, that's the thing. See, I don't want to turn it into a political discussion, but again, it's really, I'm shocked how much it like really is against landlordism and capitalism, this film. It's like, I'm surprised they got away with it and didn't get in fact, no, hang on, didn't they get in a bit of trouble? It got called like a communist movie.
Yes, it got called a communist movie, but they got away with a lot here because, you know, this was one of the few movies during the age of, you know, of the Breen era where, you know, they actually had a character who was able to get away with doing something. You know, he was able to get away with doing the crime. You know, at the end of this movie, nobody catches, you know, the fact that Potter stole the money.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. It really goes to great lengths to show that he's just the worst of the worst, isn't he? He's like the lowest of the low.
That's right.
In any other movie, it might come across a bit cartoony, but it works in this.
That's right. So
because of the subtleties you've mentioned, like those subtleties, they make it real.
Yes. I think you're right about that. So the name Blatz, have you ever heard that before?
Sounds familiar. I don't know.
Okay, so I actually found a few people whose last names were Blatz, and you know, I don't think any of them are really connected to anything that happens in this movie. But then this is something connected to you. There is an American punk rock band that was formed in 1989 that were named Blatz.
That might be why it sounds familiar.
They perform together with Operation Ivy, Filth, Green Day, things like that. They came out
Aha,
of,
there you go. Yeah.
they were part of the Gilman Street Project scene, which probably means more to you than it means to me, that phrase.
Yeah, that's where all those bands sort of came up in the early, well, late 80s, early 90s, like your Green Days and stuff. Because people might make fun of Green Day now being a big stadium band, but they, love them or hate them, they started out at the bottom.
Right. Well, most people start off at the bottom. You gotta work your way up.
No, but I mean, these days they bloody don't. These days you just need a record label to back you, and there you go. They make you a star overnight.
But you start
but no,
off at the
Green Day
bottom.
Actually, Green Day started out hitting small little clubs and things like that. So you gotta respect them for that.
Okay. Right. So, and then the third thing that I found with Blatz is that Blatz was a beer brewing company in America. And they produced beer from 1851 to 1959. And then they were sold to Pabst. So what's very interesting is it's very possible that there is some sort of connection here. That basically they're making a joke about the fact that, this congressman is somehow connected to, the booze industry, which what was going on in around this time? Again, we don't know the exact year of this scene. Maybe it's 1932, maybe it's 1933, but what was going on at that time in America when it comes to drinking? Anything you can think of?
I mean, I can think of, would that be prohibition kind of
That was
beer?
still prohibition,
Yeah.
right? Prohibition ended in 1933, on December 5th, 1933. So again, I don't know how close this scene is to that or not. But my assumption is that it's very close. Even if this scene takes place, in the beginning of 1934, this is right afterwards. So, in some
Yeah.
ways, I think it's sort of a way for them to emphasize the whole idea of drinking. This isn't the first time in this movie that, prohibition has come up. We talked about the fact that Harry wanted he wanted to drink, I think it was gin at the at his
Yeah.
graduation party, and his father told him, no drinking.
Well,
Uncle Billy was drinking, when they had the run on the bank.
and I wonder if there's a connection because, I mean, literally the previous scene from this, George hands over wine.
Yeah, that's right.
I wonder if there's some kind of a message going on here. I'm gonna have to deep dive on this in my head because it's contrasting the two, you know.
Right. So, I mean, according to what I found, that during Prohibition, Blatz produced non-alcoholic beverages such as malt soaps, sodas, and near beer.
Oh, okay.
And then in 1933, once the Prohibition ended, they were given permission to resume brewing beer.
It's such a wild concept. I live in a country that's drunk 24 hours a day. So to me, I prohibition, oh my Lord.
Well, apparently, it's a foreign concept to a lot of people because a lot of people were against it, which is why
I'm still amazed it happened.
it ended. Well, that's the way it is. Again, it happened, and then people realized their mistake. So
Yeah.
you sort of have to give them something about that.
I mean, yeah, you could say they tried it, realized it was stupid, and quite swiftly changed back.
I don't know if there is 13 years or 14 years considered swift. I don't
I
know.
would say in the grand scheme of society and politics and culture, that's pretty quick.
Okay. All right. That's
Well,
fair.
plus everyone was drinking anyway.
That's
There was
true.
no point.
That's a good point. Right. Okay. And then Potter turns back to the rent collector and says, "Go on." He goes, 15 years ago, half a dozen houses stuck here and there. There's that old cemetery, squirrels, buttercups, daisies. I used to hunt rabbits there myself. Look at it today. Dozens of the prettiest little homes you ever saw. 90% owned by suckers who used to pay rent to you. Your Potter's Field, my dear Mr. Employer, is becoming just that. And are the local yokels?" And then he gets cut off at the end of this minute.
Oh.
I love the fact that you mentioned earlier in this minute that you really like this character and you wish we saw more of him. I definitely agree with you on that. This is a guy who who knows what's going on. He can see that as powerful as Potter is, Bailey is finding a way to become even more popular and powerful.
Yeah, yeah. He sees the power in the people. It's the people power.
That's right.
George is harnessing it.
That's correct. Now, are you familiar with the term Potter's Field?
No, like outside of anything to do with this film.
Okay, so Potter's Field is actually a term used for a pauper's grave or a common grave. Usually okay. It's where, you know, people are buried that, you know, you don't have anywhere else to put them.
That's yes, okay. Now that you mentioned it, I have heard the phrase and didn't realize that's what it was talking about. Okay.
Yeah, it actually comes from a biblical origin in the New Testament, because it comes from the word akeldama, which means field of blood in Aramaic.
Oh.
And it, Judas Iscariot's suicide. And basically they used the coins that were paid to Judas for his identification of Jesus.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And therefore the priests, you know, have acquired it for the burial of strangers, criminals, and the poor. So the coins paid to Judas being considered blood money.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's where the whole idea of a potter's field comes from. And, I mean, it's something, it was in Matthew. I mean, I've never read the New Testament, so I can't really go into information about that, because I don't really know about that.
Wrong person if we're going
to
do that.
No, I'm definitely the wrong person to be dealing with the New Testament. Yeah. And
but, I wonder if him being called Potter then is some kind of... Is it alluding to that in some way, like a Judas kind of a thing?
It's very possible.
Because he's betraying his people.
Is he betraying his? He's betraying everybody because he doesn't care.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. The you know, he's a person who lives there. He's betraying everyone who lives around him. Well, does he live there though? He's that rich. He probably doesn't. He probably lives out of town.
No, I'm assuming no. He actually does. Okay, this is something that you if. Only when you do something minute by minute can you tell. So in one of the very first scenes of the movie, when the boys are skating on the ice pond, so you can see a sign saying property of H. Potter.
Ah, there you go.
So, you know, they were the pond is right near his estate.
Yeah.
You know, so is that within the city limits of Bedford Falls? I would assume it is.
I'd think so. You wouldn't let your kids go too far out of the.
Well, that's one thing. And second thing is also he, you know, he is very involved in all the politics of Bedford Falls. If he was living somewhere else, they wouldn't let him be so involved.
Well, unfortunately, in England these days, it doesn't matter. They just bring in anyone from outside and try and get them to run things. And it's like, that's not going to work. Uh-huh. That's a stupid idea.
Okay. Could be. That's basically how this minute ends. Did you have anything else you wanted to say about this minute before we get into today's segment?
No, that's pretty much everything. I think we've touched on most of the key parts.
Okay, great. So every Monday we have a segment called Capra Monday, where my guests will give their top five Frank Capra movies. So, John, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Well, it's going to be very, very short. Because, right, I'm going to shock you.
You don't have five.
This is the only one I've seen.
Uh-huh.
The only one. I looked through the list. There's like I pride myself as a film person, so I am ashamed to say this because, you know, I've always known the name, very famous name. I've heard of some of the other movies. Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, plural. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Heard of all these. And it dawned on me when I was looking through, like, I've only seen parodies of these movies.
Oh, wow.
I haven't watched them. And it's like, oh, now, though, maybe this will make me go and watch. So this was legitimately, going through the IMDb, the only one. And because my knowledge of this era of Hollywood is a bit more limited than I think my big knowledge really kicks in the 70s onwards, mm-hmm. That kind of thing. And I do like certain, I've got quite a lot of the old Universal horror movies, you know, like Frankenstein, Dracula, Wolfman, things like that. But in between there to the 70s, it's like, nope.
Oh, well. Okay. Well, you have what to try and, you know, make up for.
Absolutely, absolutely, because they all look interesting when I'm checking them out here, and I wasn't aware as a history graduate with an affinity for war related things. I didn't realize he made loads of like propaganda movies and stuff.
Oh yeah.
So I'm like, oh, I've got to watch them out of curiosity now, because I find propaganda movies very interesting, because you have to view them through a certain lens.
Yes.
And understand that what you're watching probably isn't true. And that's fine, because propaganda is not a dirty word necessarily, but you know, it's trying to put across a very specific message. And as long as you're aware of what they're doing, you can view it through that lens and see the historical kind of significance.
Right.
So I want to check him out and see what he's got to offer on that front.
You've got your homework done.
Director's doing that. Yeah, absolutely. I'm going. I might go for the two I mentioned just because they're the big ones. You know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and things like that. I don't know if they're going to be the best ones, but I might as well get the big hitters out of the way first.
Yes, I definitely recommend you do that.
I mean, I saw the. I don't want to call it a remake. I saw didn't Adam Sandler do a Mr. Deeds?
Yes, Adam Sandler did a Mr. Deeds.
I saw that.
And Eddie Murphy did a Mr. Smith remake also.
Oh yeah, I think I might have seen
The Distinguished Gentleman.
Yeah. Oh God. See, that's even more shameful. I've seen them too, and I haven't seen the real ones.
There you go. Ugh. All right, John, you have your assignment. You know, before you come back next season. I won't make you do it for the rest of this week, but you know, for the next.
No, I'll go watch them now. We'll pause for like 8 hours while I go watch some movies.
All right, we'll do that. All right. So, do you want to tell people where they can find John Parker?
Yeah, if you want to hear more of me for some stupid reason, you can check out.
Oh, come on! Don't disparage yourself.
My main one, I would probably say, just because it's been going so bloody long, is Bat Minute. You can find all these just on all the social media or anywhere you listen to podcasts. So I've got Bat Minute, where we do this same thing, but with the Batman movies. We've finished. Oh, we've done 5 films now, so we're gonna do a mini season, and then we're gonna gear up for a 6th proper one. And I also have the podcast Hedwig Inch by Angry Inch, if you like rock and roll musicals. And I've got loads of cool guests on that. That's pretty much done now, with only the occasional bonus episode popping up. So if you want one that you can sort of listen to and then be done with, yeah, go with that. And I've got another show, Miami Minutes, which is doing this with the lost 80s martial arts disaster Miami Connection. Which was only discovered in the when was it discovered? Gee, I should know this. I'm blanking now because I'm on the spot. Basically, it was made in the 80s, and they found it about 15 years ago in a garage.
Okay, that works. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe. Any podcatcher might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for a Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.